Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. With Columbia, Tennessee-based EnergizeHealth.com, you lose fat fast, simply, and naturally without restrictive exercise or cardboard, dry, tasteless food. Revolutionize your health with this proprietary 88-day science from John and Chelsea Jubilee. People report getting off medications and reversing ailments. Energy, mental clarity, and alertness go through the roof. Look and feel many years younger and oftentimes unrecognizable. I know, I'm an alumnus and lost 70 pounds of fat with John and Chelsea and wouldn't have energy to do three shows a week without it. Hit the link in show notes for your free consultation and discount. Money back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose but unhealthy fat. EnergizedHealth.com. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with FBI whistleblower Steve Friend. Steve Friend grew up in Savannah, Georgia, is an opinion writer, author, and former state and federal law enforcement officer with more than a decade of experience. He worked as a patrolman and narcotics agent in Savannah, Georgia, before joining the Federal Bureau of Investigation in 2014. Steve investigated violent crimes and major offenses occurring on Indian reservations in Northeast Nebraska for 7 years. Friend was also a member of the FBI Omaha SWAT team for 5 years. He transferred to Daytona Beach in 2021 to investigate child exploitation, human trafficking, and child sexual abuse material. Friend was reassigned to domestic terrorism casework in October 2021. Steve became an FBI whistleblower in 2022 after making protected disclosures to Congress about the FBI's questionable and manipulative investigations on January 6th protesters. Steve is the author of True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to FBI Whistleblower. He is a 2007 graduate of the University of Notre Dame and holds a Bachelor's of Science in Accounting. Steve is a married father of two sons. Hello, Steve. Welcome back to the show. Your second time on with us, way back episode 17. Wow, today is 93. So we both come a long way since then, this time on video. How are you today?
I'm doing well, and thank you very much for round two. I remember the first time we talked, it was the night of the red wave that didn't happen.
That's right. That is right. Boy, have we come far, far, far. And what a day to have you as my guest, the day after the long, long, long awaited Durham report finally comes out. We'll definitely get into that. But last time you were here, you were on leave and now indefinitely suspended. You say you had come out as a whistleblower and before the FBI tried to prevent you from getting a job, denying your request to earn a living. That's retaliation in most normal non-government jobs. How do they think they could get away with that?
Well, the FBI has kind of figured out a hack with the veil of national security. So they suspend your security clearance because you're unable to work in the FBI as an agent without a security clearance. And they find a trivial reason, if need be, to do it, to escort you out. And then they let that investigation or that farcical investigation go on for years on end, if necessary, to essentially wait you out for financial reasons, because unlike the federal government, you can't print money if you're a private citizen. So in my case, they suspended my clearance for improperly accessing the employee handbook and walked me out of the building last September. And then, as you said, prevented me from getting outside employment. And I made multiple requests. They also stopped me from getting my training records, which the Privacy Act says they're supposed to furnish me. And then when I eventually got some of those documents, they refused to validate that they're actually authentic. So when I tried to get a license to be a private investigator or get a firearms license in the state of Florida, the FBI said, well, we can't confirm or deny if those records are real. So they're effectively useless. So it's definitely been a lot of retaliation and ended with my resignation from the Bureau on February 15th of this year when I was walking in to testify at a transcribed deposition interview for the Weaponization Subcommittee under the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about that. But in the meantime, you now have a book. And I read from you, actually, that they were trying to stop you from releasing passages of the book. It's called True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to Whistleblower, available now for pre-order out June 13th, I think. Tell me if I'm wrong. Tell us what they were upset about that's in it that you are going to release anyway.
Well, everything that's potentially embarrassing to them, I think, is what they want to just stamp out. But the book is, the first half is more of a reflection on, you know, my upbringing, my experiences as a police officer and an FBI agent, and some of the good work that I got a chance to be a part of. But the issue for them, is, as they told me 3 weeks ago, that the things that they want redacted are everything pertaining to my whistleblower disclosure, which is ridiculous because that's a matter of public record that's already been put in the public sphere, and I have permission to talk about it. Everything that pertained to the Gretchen Whitmer takedown, which I happen to be part of in my capacity as a SWAT operator. And then finally, a transcript of my meeting with my executives, my executive supervisors, where I brought forward my disclosures. They revealed some and had some very choice words there that I think the Bureau finds pretty disturbing and embarrassing, and they don't want that reaching the public ear.
So the Gretchen Whitmer case, I did not know you were involved in that. That, if I'm not mistaken, sort of fell apart in the court, didn't it? They couldn't get any witnesses to testify against the people that they were accusing because they were all government employees and it was entrapment. Is that about right?
You would think that it was going to be impossible, but of the four gentlemen, two were convicted, two had mistrials, then the federal government again retried those cases, which is pretty unusual, and got successful convictions. So all four of those men were found guilty for, yes, as you said, a situation where there was 3/4 of the people in the room were either government informants or undercovers, and they essentially entrapped these guys into this notion that they were going to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer and execute her, but none of them really were predisposed to engage in anything like that. And there was actual proof that along the way, the whole plot, if you will, was falling apart, and the FBI went through great lengths to hold it together so they could, in effect, bring this case forward.
And they couldn't find lawyers to defend them competently to prove that this was entrapment, this was a setup, this was not guilty?
I think the federal judges at this point are not really holding due process in high regard, as we saw with the Whitmer case and then with January 6th. If you look at the most recent, the Proud Boy conviction, it seemed that the judge was definitely coming down on the side of the government quite heavily there. And I think it's probably pretty similar for what went on in Michigan.
Ugh, very terrible. Okay, so Post Hill Press is putting out your book, owned by Simon & Schuster, offices in Nashville, Tennessee, where I am. And Paramount owns that, and they were actually willing to publish it. So good for them, but surprising. Did they give you a hard time at all?
No, they actually approached me shortly after my name became public and said, hey, would you be interested in writing this book? And I've never written a book or anything. I've always enjoyed writing, and my wife's always told me to write a book at some point. But sat down, they said it was in late September, and they needed it by Thanksgiving. So basically gave me about 6 weeks. They said 40 to 50,000 words, which to me meant nothing. I was kind of in the whole like double spaced. Remember back in the day, number of pages. I was able to knock it out in about 30 days, which sounds really impressive until you realize that I'm 37. I've been researching the book for 37 years, as it's a personal reflection. There wasn't a lot of going trips to the library or internet research going on. But I'm really proud of it. It was something that actually helped, I think, clarify a lot of things that went on. Just recalling them and putting them down, pen to paper, or typing it out, actually, I think, makes my argument stronger and prepared me to go testify for the subcommittee. And then I'm actually going to be testifying this week, so it's pretty serendipitous that we're having this conversation. I'm testifying on Thursday in an open
hearing. You're back on May 18th, so yeah, it'll be good. Now, usually these things are pre-cleared for government employees. So did they give you the green light and then change their minds after, when they kind of saw that you were popular? Because it is a New York Times number one bestseller. Not New York Times, but it is a number one bestseller. Or maybe it is New York Times. I don't know. You tell us.
It's Amazon. Amazon right now.
Okay.
But it's in pre-sale, so they can't put me on any list until the actual sale date comes out. And we'll see how that comes to pass. But no, I just typed it out on my own and told the Post Hill Press, look, we're going to go forward. And then, as a courtesy, sent the PDF document over to the FBI and told them, look, I've got pre-publication review office has cleared me to talk about the whistleblower component. Nothing else is classified or state secrets or anything like that. I am going to publish this book. And they took their sweet time, came back to me and said, we need your name and a summary of what you're writing. And I told them that's all in the PDF so they could read it themselves to find out. And then 3 weeks ago, heard back finally from them. And I think my publisher was a little concerned if I was going to get wishy-washy, but I'm fully confident that everything I did was above the board. And I really just want the information to get out to as many people as possible, regardless of their political leanings. I think it's vital information to all Americans. And then I've now started to actually encourage people to buy second copies if they can, to send over to Christopher Wray at the Hoover Building as a gift, because and although he has oversight, he's been on record saying he's pretty much bubble wrapped and not really aware of what's going on in the FBI. And maybe this will inform him, get him up to speed on what's going on.
Yeah, if you believe that line. But good for you. Congratulations. Being a number one bestseller with your first time is fantastic. So yeah, everybody buy two or three. Usually when I brought authors on, I've read the book and go over what's in it. But since my autographed advanced copy hasn't arrived yet, Steve, I'll just ask you, what was the process of writing it like? And what is it you want people to read and understand most about your time at the FBI and what you went through?
Yeah. One of the great things about being a police officer is that you just have all these great stories and great experiences. And if you're ever in a social setting with police officers, you got to sit down and take a few minutes with them, because all of our stories are really well edited and they're just entertaining. So I got a chance to write a few chapters where, you know, it was the quintessential, somebody's got to write this book, and put a lot of those stories down, and then really kind of show how they impacted me as a man and as an investigator, and provide the background for why I decided to eventually blow the whistle on the things that I saw going on within the FBI. I think the biggest thing that I want, or would hope that people would take away, is that I'm just a regular guy. And I was very fortunate professionally to have my dream job. I didn't feel like I ever worked a day in my life. I was just always on Monday, had no dread, wanted to go into work and do the FBI thing. When push came to shove for me, and seeing what has gone on with the FBI's willingness to become sort of this political instrument and weaponized against significant portions of the American population, of which I don't agree politically with some of their worldviews, it doesn't matter. And I think that is something that I hope that people will realize about me. And I'm hoping that other FBI agents will take to heart, because I come fond of saying that the FBI oath of office is not an iPhone user agreement. Mm-hmm. You actually have to take that oath seriously. It doesn't retire. It doesn't resign. The FBI oath of office doesn't expire until you do. It's not just something that you just select yes on.
And that's what's been so sorely missing, is that oath of office hasn't been looked at with any consequences, that you take that oath and it's supposed to be for life. And you say, I solemnly swear I will do this, and they were not doing this. We'll get into that for sure. But I look forward to having you back on for the Steve and Steve Show Part 3 when you do the sequel to the book, with how all this resolves in a positive, sure, happy ending, I hope, for you. But you have been making the rounds quite a bit. You work with Emerald Robinson, too. What's she like, and her producer, Brianna Morello?
Brianna's great. She's a hoot. I text with her quite frequently, and she's got a great sense of humor. And she reaches out to me, and Emerald's obviously a big supporter of FBI whistleblowers and has wanted to bring my story out and other whistleblower stories out as well. I told them, and Brianna actually said that I needed to update my Twitter biography, my bio, because I was completely new to social media. I didn't know. I didn't have anything in there. So I made sure to put that I was an indispensable contributor to The Absolute Truth with Emerald Robinson, because that's self-preservation. I figured they got to keep having me on, which fortunately for me, she has kept having me on, but might be unfortunate, because it seems to be every time I'm going on there, it's not to talk about my story, but some other malfeasance or screw up by the FBI, which is all too common nowadays.
Yeah, you have become the authority on all things not working at the FBI. And you were supposed to be a joint guest on with me a while back with your fellow FBI whistleblower, Kyle Serafin, but you had to testify in front of Jim Jordan's committee. So I understand the priorities there. It's been a few months since Republicans took back the majority and that committee was even formed. Do you think anything will come of it? And you said you are back this week. Is it just more of the same, or are we actually seeing progress from inside those doors?
You know, I think the jury is still out on it. I think that they came at this too slowly. I think that there's a lot of things that they want to investigate, and they're sort of become a little bit like a cat looking at a laser pointer. They get easily distracted because everybody who's associated with the committee is an elected official. And obviously there's a little bit of self-preservation in that and get elected. And what gets me on the news is whatever gets me on the news is what's in the news. You know, that's not always FBI whistleblowing, but I think now, from what I've in my interactions with the committee and the staff on there, they've staffed up, they've gotten some attorneys, they've gotten some and there seems to be an appetite now to find out what information we had to bring forward that is not necessarily what we're typecast into. And I think that their hesitancy with me is January 6th is just not a palatable issue for both Republicans and Democrats. Well, obviously, the Democrats want to talk about it because I think they believe it helps them electorally, but the Republicans are fearful that it helps the Democrats electorally, and they don't want to talk about it. But and as you'll see in the information I brought out in my book and then the things I talked about in my deposition, January 6th is the most egregious example that I could find about the IPM protocols that the FBI has, the integrated program management metrics that it establishes for itself to meet statistical accomplishments that are arbitrary. And just think of it as a cop that's writing tickets, a traffic cop, and got to hit the quota. And the fact that the FBI is setting these quotas for itself to meet, and the fact that it's leading to the FBI getting these enhanced budgets, which is obviously not fiscally responsible. And it's leading to compensation being awarded to the highest level managers within the FBI. They actually get bonuses on it. And I think that that is something that is pretty egregious and that should fire up a lot of Americans across the political spectrum, because it's not limited to January 6th. It's you know, been in effect for a long time. So hopefully that information can get out to the representatives that will discuss them enough to maybe take some corrective action when it comes to appropriating money to the FBI, or not appropriating the money as I would prefer. And we'll just have to see what happens on Thursday and if they take it seriously.
Yeah, really unbelievable. And we have another election next year. That's the problem with Congress. It's every 2 years. So the majority is thin and may not even be there. And if Democrats take back the House, that's the end of that, I would think. But you think something will happen, or not 50-50?
Yeah. Hope springs eternal. You know, I wouldn't be going if I didn't think anything was going to happen. Okay. I you know, talked to some of them on the committee. My attorney has very experienced with these matters. He was a staffer for multiple members of Congress who are still there. And he seems confident that the information I have is going to be important to bring out. And although we have this one more election next year, there is the budget process that happens between now and then. And I was actually at an event this past weekend with some members on the Appropriations Committee, and they're holding fast to this. We're not going to do an omnibus. We're going to do 12 separate appropriation bills. If that actually happens, that we might actually see the power of the purse actually rein in some of the eccentricities and weaponizations that we've seen.
Oh, defund the actual police. Okay. Well, newly in the news, intelligence analyst Marcus Allen, not the running back for the USC Trojans and Raiders, is the newest name of a whistleblower out there, claims retaliation for Ray's January 6th testimony. So you have a compatriot now. Excuse me. Do you know him?
I don't know him. And actually, I was trying to connect with him, and it's been one of those guys that's eluded through, fallen through the cracks as I've developed my network out. But obviously, I'm going to meet him on Thursday, and I think going forward, he and I will probably be pretty friendly.
Great. Someone called Derek Myers came out publicly and said this: I can publicly confirm that during my brief time in the congressman's office, I had met secretly with agents from FBI in an effort to work as a confidential informant and human asset against the congressman during my course of employment in his office. I cannot go into further detail at this time. Jake Tapper said, exclusive, Rep. George Santos charged by Justice Department in federal probe. Have you come across other whistleblowers that were trying to run against sitting congressmen?
So I've talked to some people on the inside that have confirmed that this is actually more common than just the George Santos situation. And that is something that I believe the weaponization committee will be very interested in taking up, probably to my own detriment. They'll probably put me and they'll shelve me because it's their own self-preservation. But there's actually a black letter law that that they cannot, the FBI cannot infiltrate that way without some sort of communication with the House. It's just a separation of powers issue because the FBI falls underneath the executive and that's legislative. There has to be communication and almost approval for that. I think the most recent revelation that this happened with Santos is basically the camel getting his nose under the tent, because I think universally Democrats obviously hate any Republican, and the Republicans kind of view Santos the way he was able to gain his rep slot, just lying so blatantly and just flaunting it around. It kind of makes him this gross character that everybody kind of just says, all right, yeah, we should probably get rid of him by any means necessary. And that just sort of becomes a standard operating procedure. But if that's been going on for a long time or any length of time without proper protocols in place, that needs to go away right away.
It does. It reminds me of not only the FISA abuses with the judges and the foreign services, but we had the head of the CIA spying on the members of the intelligence committee, Dianne Feinstein at the time, but CIA is not allowed to work domestically. So it sounds like maybe they handed the baton off. So it's all alleged, but boy, does that sound pretty bad for what they've been doing on top of many bad things. Your friend of mine, Kyle Serafin, said about it, I have been told by a number of folks working intel for the FBI that it is common and regular. This blew my mind because I was told we needed special permissions to do such a thing in 2017. Ever wonder why there is no meaningful oversight? Is it fear, the way Hoover liked it? So not much has changed, huh? Is it fear? Is that why what are they afraid of?
Well, I mean, I think the tradition of J. Edgar Hoover was he didn't really have politics other than promoting the FBI, and then he used information as his currency there. And I think that tradition's probably kept on going forward. And it also, ensures the Bureau that they're always going to be kind of given the benefit of the doubt, if not more so, when it comes to getting the budget requests that they want through. I mean, who's to say that you can't just approach a congressman and say, hey, be ashamed if this information came forward. By the way, we have this budget vote coming up. I'd like you to come down on our side. So I think there's maybe some of those mob tactics in place. But then on the other side of things, the fear of not doing what you're told in the FBI, I think it reigns supreme. I'm definitely a black sheep when it comes to that, not because I'm particularly predisposed to just be anti-authority. I think that, again, too many people are just clicking agree on the iPhone agreement that they think their oath of office represents. And when the powers that be, the political actors within the Bureau, are giving these directives, they just put their head down and say, I'm just following orders. And if history teaches us anything, that's just not going to be an acceptable answer when we look back on history.
Yeah. And for those that don't remember or don't have time to go back and listen to the previous episode, you took a stand because you were asked while working in Florida to be involved in the Mar-a-Lago raid that had never been done before to a former president ever. And you said no. And so you took a stand.
That wasn't Mar-a-Lago. It was January 6th individuals who were cooperative with the FBI. And, at least in my experience, having arrested over 150 violent criminals, tactical team use of these large scale arrest operations, or a SWAT team for misdemeanor, or people who are represented by attorneys or pledged to be cooperative, is an unnecessary risk to public safety. That's how Ruby Ridge happens. That's how Waco happens. If people are just too in positions of leadership or trying to serve two masters, not just only achieve the mission and bring and apprehending somebody, but trying to do it with a splash so that they can put it on their FD-954, which is the FBI document to promote, and say you did something in a novel way, and that's going to help further your career. And I think there's too many people that are doing that nowadays.
So like we saw with the Roger Stone raid, where they had 15 frogmen and helicopters, and it was the middle of the night, and he's old and his wife is hard of hearing, but yet they were guns drawn, thankfully not blazing, and CNN was there 15 minutes before. So
Mark Halk, the gentleman that was outside the Philadelphia abortion clinic praying, and then they charged him with the FACE Act violation because he had a employee come out and start berating his young son, and then he as any father would and should and you'd expect, stood in the way. But the federal government chose to prosecute him even after the local and state authorities said, look, that's not a crime that we deem worthy of any sort of criminal prosecution. But the FBI chose to get itself involved in that and bring a charge down on him. And he was facing 10, 11 years in prison for that. And then, you know, and take the other side of FACE Act, which nobody seems to realize is there's another clause in there. It's not just in putting yourself in the way of somebody trying to enter an abortion clinic. It's also interfering with a religious ceremony. So all these protesters that put themselves, especially during the 2020 riots, you know, in the churches and started demanding, you know, Black Lives Matter, take a knee for us, and were just disrupting these regular church services. Those are FACE Act violations, yet the FBI didn't deem those worthy of any sort of criminal prosecution.
Interesting. And, you know, it's the Federal Bureau of Investigations. When did it become prosecutions or hounding people into the prison cells? I mean, it had a change of culture that you can almost peg, if I'm not mistaken, to right around when Bob Mueller took over.
Yeah, I think that it was put in place shortly after 9/11. That's when the mission creep came home after the Patriot Act, and the focus on national security was enhanced, and the unlimited amount of funds that were made available were really seen. And that's when the FBI started to generate these cases, because they had to justify their existence. They had to keep that self-licking ice cream cone that is the federal government satisfied. Bob Mueller pushed it. Jim Comey then went on top of that and put his "I'm beyond all ethical reproach" label on it. And that, unfortunately, is now, because so many people who are in a position of leadership in the FBI came up when Comey was the director, that sort of mentality still exists. And there's people that are not even willing to consider that they might be the bad guys in any situation. And they're the ones that are calling the shots with the FBI. And then finally, as I talked before, the integrated program management system was brought in about 10 years ago, 2013, 2014 time. And I think that's no coincidence that even recently, I think the GAO came out, the Government Accountability Office, and they said that the number of domestic terrorism cases has quadrupled in 10 years. Well, if you ask for something, you will get more of it if it leads to more money for the agency and financial compensation and benefit for the employees. And that's what's come to pass.
Wow, it's really become a business model of how to screw people over, even though we pay the taxes that fund them. So that brings us to today. The long, long, long awaited Durham report came out yesterday. Didn't really tell us anything we didn't know, but it did confirm that it was Nelly Orr who first dug up Sergey Milyon. And I know these names, probably most people don't. You do. But as a potential source for the Steele dossier, months later, Milyon falsely claimed the main source for the most explosive allegations in the dossier, according to Paul Sperry at Real Clear Investigations, was him. Do you think Steele and Stroke and Page and Baker and Comey, all these names from the past now, will ever see justice for election interference at least?
No, there won't. There will be no accountability. I think that was actually sort of the prime directive when it came to assigning Durham to do this investigation. No matter what, make sure it takes long enough so that the old Clinton-esque plan of drip, drip, drip for years and years until it's no longer relevant, no longer in the news. This is old news. Why are we talking about this? I think that is a tried and true strategy, and it was applied here. And unfortunately, these guys have, you know, they're going to be able to say, like, take Peter Strzok. He'll say, look, I was fired. There was accountability here. But I don't think anybody who is an honest and unbiased or impartial observer of what went on thinks that him losing his job but then getting a paid TV gig and writing a book, that's real justice. I think if there's any sort of justice that we could see from that is, and as I've been saying since this report came out, this needs to be the final nail in the coffin. This should be the death knell for the FBI as America's premier law enforcement agency, as America's federal law enforcement agency of record. Because how long is it before outside of a left-leaning, heavily liberal city, should a jury sit in the box when an FBI case is brought forward and take anything the FBI says on its face as being real or true when it's now been confirmed by this Durham report that the FBI is willing to open up full investigations without any evidence. And they're actually willing to just use the arms and the levers of power to pursue a narrative victory that they wanted when that's not, in fact, their job.
Not just no evidence, but planted evidence, like when they changed the Kevin Kleinsmith, I think his name, the yes to no, or
yeah,
or making up the Sergei Milyon, or trying to stick $10,000 in Papadopoulos's flight bag so that he would get busted for something ridiculous like that. I mean, these things I would hope would stick in a jury's mind if they've ever heard about it, and that's a problem too. So Durham finds the Department of Justice, FBI, failed to uphold mission of strict fidelity to the law in Trump-Russia probe. Durham began investigating origins of Crossfire Hurricane in 2019. Based on the review of Crossfire Hurricane and related intelligence activities, we conclude that the department and the FBI failed to uphold their mission of strict fidelity to the law in connection with certain events and activities described in this report, the report said. So now you say that's not going to happen, but there are still some of those folks still there. Christopher Wray and Blinken and the rest, will anyone be marched out of there and go to jail? Or is this really just now turn the page, moveon.org, on to the next election?
I think we're going to get a lot of the moveon.org unless there's some energetic members within that. I'm just immediately thinking of that group of 20 that held out for the speaker fight, that they could maybe have an impact on something like appropriations. So I believe there's four members on the Appropriations Committee that were within those ranks of 20, did some simple back of the envelope math on that. So the Appropriations Committee is 31 Republicans, 27 Democrats, it's 28 Democrats. Okay. So if you subtract four from the 31, it adds over to the Democrat side, and they're able to actually hold some power in the appropriations. And if you get them fired up about that, and they can maybe zero out some salaries, defund significant portions of the FBI, where you know, you're able to rein this in just from a procedural standpoint, just from its ability to act going forward, to essentially defang these sort of actions that have gone on. But if you just look backwards and try to hold individuals accountable, unfortunately, there's just going to be somebody else that replaces them. Right. The culture of promotion within the FBI is completely broken. And really the only one that's appointed is Christopher Wray. Everybody else has just sort of come up through the viper's nest rankings within FBI headquarters. And then if you look at the head of the snake with Christopher Wray, just did basic math on that guy. He had a salary of $9 million the year before he became the FBI director. So he gave up $90 million when you 9 times 10 year appointment.
Yeah.
That he deems the FBI to be a success at this point. That's what ideological conviction looks like. Somebody who's willing to make that financial commitment to the cause. And he's obviously content, and he's able to sit and talk to Bret Baier and say that things have never been better at the FBI, because in a down economy with inflation out of control, the applications are really off the charts.
So the report also said the department did not adequately examine or question these materials and the motivations of those providing them, even when at about the same time the director of the FBI and others learned of significant and potentially contrary intelligence. The report said that would have been Comey at the time. Durham is referring to, like I just said, past FBI leadership in his report, specifically former FBI James Comey and former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Does he get to skate too?
Well, he did. I mean, he'll claim that he was fired and lost his pension. But then, wouldn't you know it, the Biden administration came in, Merrick Garland was made attorney general. He sued, and out of court, they immediately settled, restored all of his back pay, his pension, and they paid his legal fees. And I believe he raised somewhere in the area of $500,000 within 3 days of setting up a GoFundMe, because he portrayed himself as a hero of the American left. And back to what my comments about Ray, they put their money where their mouth is. That's what ideological conviction is. And he's the one who got Trump from their perspective. So you know, he needs to be rewarded financially.
Did you mention his pay contract with MSNBC?
No.
That counts.
It does count. It does count for the few dozen that watch.
One thing I noticed is Durham did not recommend any changes to guidelines or policy. So that means every failure along the way was directly in violation of guidelines or policy. Yeah. So best we can get is they stay fired, I guess. But of course, a new administration could always appoint them Homeland Security or something. Let's see. False stories linking Trump to Russia. Millions of hours of media. Russia was hatched in August 2016 by Brennan, Clinton, Obama, Biden, A.G. Lynch, and Comey. It's right there in the report, Section C, number one. All we can do is watch them tweet now. Nothing.
No. And really, if anything, it's spiking the football. That shows that 2016 was really a prelude to 2020. You had the Russia happen. I guess it didn't impact enough to prevent Donald Trump from winning the presidency. Even when Hillary Clinton, there was ample evidence to charge her with a crime. The FBI director stepped out of his lane and said no reasonable prosecutor would bring charges against her. That wasn't his decision, but he let Loretta Lynch off the hook because in his view, he thought he had a safe 10-year appointment and she was going to be, her incumbency was contingent on Hillary Clinton winning the election. So cut Loretta Lynch a little bit of a break there. Didn't pan out for them in 2016, but then flash forward to 2020, where the intelligence committee community and these entrenched bureaucrats and people who find themselves in positions of power and think that they get to decide who should be in charge of the country, mobilized when it came to this Hunter Biden laptop and all signed on to this campaign talking point for Joe Biden to drop during a presidential debate in the lead up to the election and say that it had all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation. Again, bringing us back to Russia, and hiding the fact that that the Biden family could be profiting from Joe Biden's connections to foreign allies.
I guess the silver lining is that it does shine the light on what was happening behind the scenes. There are three bullet points I just want to throw out and see what you think. Number one that I took out of it, FBI Director James Comey was deeply interested in the Crossfire Hurricane investigation and micromanaged it, demanding the Carter Page FISA warrant, telling Assistant Director Andrew McCabe, where is the FISA? Where is the FISA? So we know his fingerprints are all over this, even though he lied. Durham documents two investigations into Hillary Clinton, not just one involving the Clinton Foundation and one involving illegal foreign contributions to Clinton's campaign. Would love to see the results of that. In February 2016, FBI Assistant Director Andrew McCabe directed the Clinton Foundation investigation to be shut down. So we never will see that. He walked that back after receiving pushback, but McCabe made sure that his approval was required for any further investigative steps. So we got the smoking gun all over the place. I guess we just have to make sure to tune them out when they come on TV to talk about anything because they're just not credible people anymore.
They're not credible, but again, they're not ashamed. I think they pulled a mask off. That's why Christopher Wray can tell Senate hearing, like, look, I got a plane to catch. It's his private plane. But he's going to leave and there's nothing you can do to stop him. And James Comey can come out and sort of in a laugh line say that he sent two agents over to interview Mike Flynn at the White House. Again, that's it was an appointment. And he thought just because of the chaos of the new administration coming in, they'd be able to go and talk to him, hope that they could contrive a process crime where he would be lack candor in some way. And then they could bring charges against him because obviously Mike Flynn was not a preferred person for the role of NSA that James Comey and his ilk believed should be filling that role.
Not just not preferred, but the guy who knew where all the bodies were buried and probably could have exposed them in at the moment, as opposed to 4 years later or 6 years later. So at least shifting gears a little bit now, at least five whistleblowers have come forward to allege wrongdoing by the Biden family in connection with business schemes and corresponding cover-ups. So that's real time. That's not looking back to 2016. Do you think anything will come out of these whistleblowers, or are they just going to be in the annals of history in some write-up book on the far right that nobody's going to pay attention to? Or could we actually see some justice?
I think it all depends on what you think justice is. So I have my own ideas here. I think that we're going to see a lot of attention, a lot more attention to this, because I don't think the Democrat Party wants Joe Biden to run for president in 2024. And he has obviously put his claim to that mantle, and he said he's going to run again. But if they can gin up enough attention about his son and potential other family members, because at his core, I mean, look, I don't agree with Joe Biden on just about any sort of policy issue, but I do think that, with the exception of one grandchild, he does love his family. And I don't think he wants them to suffer because he's not willing to step aside for the next preferred candidate for the Democrat Party. And again, that's the problem with all these princelings. Like, we can say, well, Joe Biden was never the one profiting, but if all of his net worth is eventually bequeathed to his progeny and his grandkids and his children, so in essence, he was essentially profiting from what was going on. But back to the point at hand, I think that these stories will gain some traction with not just right-leaning media, but with mainstream media, if in fact they want him to exit gracefully out and say, thank you for your service. You beat the orange man, but now we have to bring in the next generation of leadership. So
you're probably right. I mean, they have been noticeably interested in this when normally most people would have heard it for the first time this week. Like, you know, I've been following this for a long time. You lived it. I've been watching it. But I think some people just heard this for the first time this week that, wait, Biden's kind of corrupt. Wow, I hadn't heard that. I wanted to read the FBI statement to you in response to the Durham report and get your opinion on it. They submitted it today, as a matter of fact. The conduct in 2016 and 17 that Special Counsel Durham examined was the reason that current FBI leadership already implemented dozens of corrective actions, which have now been in place for some time. Had those reforms been in place in 2016, the missteps identified in the report could have been prevented. This report reinforces the importance of ensuring the FBI continues to do its work with the rigor, objectivity, and professionalism the American people deserve and rightly expect.
Props for the FBI for outsourcing their write-ups to MoveOn.org. because the direct 2016-2017 reference, and then at the end saying, you know, look, we already took corrective action. No need to look further. Anybody who has eyes to see and ears to hear knows that the FBI has major problems and needs massive reform. And any sort of nibbling around the edges that they're alleging that they did didn't actually have any noticeable impact.
Yeah, and still doing some things to this very day. And we have January 6 people still in jail to this day for misdemeanor trespassing. We now also know, as if we doubted it, the 51 current and former intel officials that wrote the notorious during the campaign letter giving Biden a debate talking point saying Hunter's laptop was Russian disinformation was all made up. Brennan called it political. Blinken, current Secretary of State, a bunch of powerful people, Jake Sullivan. Are we just supposed to let them continue doing their day job and getting a government salary? Or can Jordan, who you're talking to this week, pull them in and rein them in and maybe see some firings? Or is the Justice Department and the presidency just too powerful?
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to actually have any personnel changes. I've been on calls where they expressed that. They said, look, we can initiate some sort of impeachment we want over a Secretary of State, but at the end of the day, he's not going to be removed from office. The biggest thing they can do is just bring it to the American people's attention, which is one of the roles that they do have, and they should do. But unfortunately, I think it's just going to be used for cable news, political back and forth. Next time, elect my party as opposed to the other party, so we won't have this. But then, there's return fire one way or the other. So I'm not too optimistic that we're going to have any sort of changes in leadership. But do you really want one? I mean, if you swapped out Joe Biden for Gavin Newsom, do you think that his Secretary of State will be a marketable improvement over Anthony Blinken?
No, it'll probably be Jay Inslee anyway, but that's even worse. People just don't know who he is. So you were on the Child Sex Trafficking Task Force in Daytona Beach, Florida. The Title 42 just expired, and everybody's pointing at this obscure Title 8 as a easier asylum seeking claim. But we are seeing immigrants somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000, gotaways a day, or some crazy number. Which, if you multiply that by a year, it's at least a million people. Do you think we're going to now see an uptick in child trafficking? And of course, the teachers unions and the FBI were already acting like enforcement arms of the Democratic administration. We have a Democratic president, Democratic judicial branches all over the place. Is this a successful strategy that the Democrats are implementing, or are we going to be able to rein in some illegal immigration problems that we're having as well?
So I think the talking point that they're bungling the border is completely farcical. They are getting what they want. They're letting these folks cross. They're trying to overwhelm the border. I think that maybe the American population now will realize that every town is a border town, and maybe there'll be some appetite to pressure these executives at the state level to take some action. I was at an event this past weekend where former deputy director of Department of Homeland Security, Ken Cuccinelli, was there and was discussing a provision within the Constitution that enables the states to say, look, we're being invaded, and to activate and actually take some action. And it's also going to take a lot of cooperation between governors from one state and another, where essentially governors in Nebraska or Iowa or South Dakota, where there's a Republican governor, will send forces to assist at the border because they know that Des Moines and Sioux Falls and Lincoln, Nebraska, are going to one day be border towns, essentially. But they're going to have to take that leap and say, look, my people are your people and you have control over them, which is a big step for a governor. But hopefully there's going to be some appetite to stop that, because I don't think anybody wants to see children, or adults for that matter, trafficked over the border. We cannot have, we fought a war. 600,000 people died in this country to stop and to end and abolish slavery. And that essentially is what we're allowing to happen right now.
I agree with that. Okay, we're almost out of time here. So yesterday, Trump said if elected president again, he will make major changes at the DOJ, FBI. So Steve, if you were magically reinstated, and let's say President Nikki Haley, I don't know, made you FBI director for a 10-year term, what would you do to fix the FBI, or the whole intelligence community for that matter, that has been so weaponized by Obama, from the NSA, CISA, FBI, all the way down to local dog catcher? Or is it hopeless?
Well, if you could choose two routes, if you're going to try to reform the FBI, you could take some significant reforms. I don't think it's possible. I think it's beyond redemption at this point. I think if you appointed me the FBI director, that's a 12-month assignment to dismantle the FBI. And then I think you need to rethink the way that we do federal law enforcement. But people might think that that sounds disturbing, or we can't possibly do that. The FBI wasn't around till the 1900s, and certainly wasn't its force that it is now until the last couple of decades. So I think we can exist. We existed before the FBI. We exist after the FBI, and we just need to bring in some good thinking on how we can do that. And briefly, how we could do that is empower the United States Marshals to deputize local sheriff's deputies and police officer detectives with the necessary experience and skills, and their agencies know that they're the guy to fill that job. And they can be cross-deputized as federal agents as well as state officers. They can investigate state crimes and federal crimes, bring the necessary charges forward, and they can actually impact the main street of their community, as opposed to doing the political bidding of people who are impacted by K Street in Washington, D.C.
I like that. And here in Tennessee, we have the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. So we really don't need the feds. And as long as I live, I don't think I'll ever forget the images of the FBI guys and gals taking a knee for BLM. That's like scarred in my mind. Neil Team Six, premier law enforcement agency, putting a big middle finger in the face of law-abiding, taxpaying Americans. You obviously saw that. Real quick, what did you think of that? And have you ever been invited on CNN or MSNBC? MSNBC?
MSNBC is never invited. CNN wanted to do an article and spoke to two of their dear journalists, and turned into a giant hit piece. But that was to be expected. Unfortunately, they weren't really interested in the facts. But just reflecting on the BLM, tactically just atrocious. It's an embarrassment. And then when you think about the fact that so many of those people were promoted after the fact, and then they were heralded by the Retired Agents Association as these stalwarts, and awarded these gift cards, which I think they actually gave back because they said they couldn't accept them. But just the premise that they were financially rewarded for doing that. The FBI is not about politics. So these statements that they say that they're nonpartisan and apolitical agency with regard to the Durham report, it hasn't borne itself out. It didn't pour itself out in 2020 with these BLM protests that were going on. That's clearly a political message when you take a knee in solidarity with one side of the aisle, especially if that side is furthering civil unrest and destruction of property and death within the country for almost a calendar year in the lead up to a presidential election.
And Kyle said that all those folks were promoted, and folks who want to hear more about Kyle can check out episode 42 and 53. I've had you all both on twice now. I'm honored.
All right.
Steve, thank you for your time. Really appreciate you. Glad your book is doing great. We're at the end here. Tell everyone where they can go to find out more about you, follow your social medias, and of course, your work at Center for Renewing America, being a senior fellow.
Thank you for that. I am on Twitter at Real Steve Friend, on Truth Social at Real _ Steve Friend. I still want to get that. That's Real Steve Friend. I don't know who has it. I work for the Center for Renewing America. It's a president of the organization is Russ Vogt. He was the director of the OMB under the Trump administration, not because I have any particular affinity for the Trump administration. I actually didn't vote for it either time, but he's doing some really great work on behalf of reining in out of control, woke and weaponized government. And I'm just hoping to contribute to that. I'm providing information about domestic intelligence and security services. So essentially knowing where the bodies are buried, hoping to advise the weaponization subcommittee. And then the book is on sale, pre-sale right now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to Suspended FBI Whistleblower. I encourage everybody to pick up a copy. It's an easy read. My wife read it. So check the box on that one.
That's great, because mine doesn't listen to my show, but that's okay. She listens to clips. And buy two, one to mail to Director Ray. Don't forget. Well, thanks again, Steve. Hope to have you on again, third time.
You got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Harvey Durham Health Insurance Agency is the trusted independent health insurance agency that you can depend on for all your health insurance coverage needs. He's great because he doesn't look at health insurance as sales. He looks at it as helping people and doing the best he can to solve your current long-term care, disability, and Medicare supplement needs, even pets. I know, I'm a client, and so is my lab, Caroline. Over 30 years of insurance experience behind every policy. Give Harvey a call at 731-727-9242 or email him at harveydurham@harveydurham.com and tell him Steve and Steve at Mill Creek View sent you.
I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down to your knees.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show where we cover what we just heard. Steve, and Steve, producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, fellow on domestic intelligence and security services at Center for Renewing America, Steve Friend?
Well, it was good to have him on. And what's interesting about it is he's found himself a new home with the fellow at being senior fellow at the Center for Renewing America. And he's now making regular appearances on several podcasts, and good on him. And I think he's going to bounce back. And then his True Blue book, wonderful. Maybe mine will someday win the top honors of being a first-time bestseller. But nonetheless, it was good to hear that. I think I want to sum up what I heard, though, Steve, is that we talked about this on the last week. But the bottom line is these guys know exactly what they're doing, the top dogs. I call them darklings. They push it in their your face, they get away with it, and it's called revelation of method, because all this stuff, the brouhaha, it all comes forward, and then you and I, as citizens, just drop our head and go, is there any justice ever in this country? And that's what they want. And we cannot allow them to crush our spirit. We need to keep moving forward. And folks, groundswell from your city councils to your local county positions, into the state level, and eventually into the state. But I like what he said. The answer is state level. Governors and sheriffs. Sheriffs have constitutional rights to do a lot more than most people understand, and marshals and this kind of thing. That's where our answers are. I don't think we'll ever find it at the federal level.
I agree. All right. The month of May is Mental Health Awareness Month. I've been looking into pharmaceutical drugs long before COVID and Turtles All the Way Down, if you remember that episode, especially prescription drugs handed out like candy to kids and medical marijuana. Ever since I watched George Soros push medical marijuana laws in Arizona and California many years ago, scientific study proves normalization is a social disaster. Health data is that 7 million people linked to mental illness rates, and adolescent males are 30% of that. Schizophrenia admitted to hospitals amongst young men. The trend increased potency of use and use products, promoting delivery of even more, only will keep going up. Profit motive and industrialization of marijuana production, promoting delivery of even more concentrated THC. This is not a popular opinion of mine. I know people that love this stuff more than their kids even, or anything else, because it's mind poison, all amped up with the legalization pushed by Soros. Let's start with clip number one.
No one should be in jail just for using or possessing marijuana. It's already legal in many states, and criminal records for marijuana possession have led to needless barriers to employment, to housing, to educational opportunities. And that's before you address the racial disparities around who suffers the consequences. While white and black and brown people use marijuana at similar rates, black and brown people are arrested, prosecuted, and convicted at disproportionately higher rates. So today, I'm taking three steps to end this failed approach. First, I'm announcing a pardon for all prior federal offenses for the simple possession of marijuana. There are thousands of people who are convicted for marijuana possession who may be denied employment, housing, or educational opportunities as a result of that conviction. My pardon will remove this burden on them. Second, I'm calling on all governors to do the same for state marijuana possession offenses. Third, the federal government currently classifies marijuana as a Schedule I substance, the same as heroin and LSD, and more serious than fentanyl. It makes no sense. So I'm asking the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Attorney General to initiate a process to review how marijuana is scheduled under federal law. Even as federal and local regulations of marijuana change, important limitations on trafficking, marketing, and underage sales should stay in place. Too many lives have been upended because of our failed approach to marijuana. It's time that we right these wrongs.
Oh, there we go.
Well, to start, so this is my cannabis warning for everybody. I may lose listeners, I don't know. But the false claims and dangers that they've been telling, not telling kids and teenagers, especially in their developing minds, I'm going to tell you about. It's addictive. They say it's not, but it makes you think you're something you aren't. 9 feet tall when you're not, just like alcohol warps the sense of who you are, which is also warping who we are as Americans. Here are some headlines. Risks outweigh benefits in cannabis use. Psychiatrists concerned over dangers of smoking cannabis. Medical cannabis unlikely to benefit most chronic pain patients. FDA warns companies to stop making false claims for THC and CBD. Schizophrenia linked to marijuana. How many people wind up in emergency rooms from new and more powerful varieties of marijuana that are out there? Even if scientifically true, you don't care. You can't be without it. You're addicted. Not everyone, of course, but some. And I need you to know this. Here's one out of Denmark. The proportion of schizophrenia cases linked with problematic use of marijuana increased over the last 25 years. 2% in 1995 associated with cannabis, 4% in 2000. Since 2010, 8%. That report is 12 years old. It could be 10 to 20% now. It's become so hip and cool, but it's not your father's or your grandfather's or my marijuana for that matter. It is laced with fentanyl, laced with rat poison, laced with all kinds of things that a developing teenage mind cannot handle. And it could also be the reason for a rise in the deadly shootings that we're seeing at schools and nightclubs. We don't know. Associated Professor Copenhagen, Research Center for Mental Health, this study cannot be done today, by the way, said, unfortunately, evidence suggests cannabis, seen as a somewhat harmless substance, this is unfortunate because link with schizophrenia poor cognitive function, substance use disorder, I think highly important to use or our study and others to highlight and emphasize that use of cannabis is not harmless. Not harmless. Use more heavily effective, more heavily. The more you use it, the more you're affected. Responsible for outbreak of violence in this country, I believe. Steve, do you know what the word hashish in Arabic means?
No, what does it mean?
Assassin. The Arab assassin smoked before their murder sprees. So that tells you a little something right there. So it's a cautionary tale I'm trying to tell you right now, enlightening you to the dangers of smoking cannabis. Study medication to combat the side effects of using cannabis and other recreational drugs to become commonplace among countries with young men. What young men? This is from Antiqua. Stark warning from internal medicine and psychiatric consultants, St. Lesterberg Medical Center, Dr. Chanel Joseph. She's currently caring for several patients, both at the hospital and her private practice, who are suffering from the negative effects of smoking marijuana. She's encouraging patients and parents to be vigilant toward their children's behavior and educate on the repercussions of using drugs, including marijuana, and how marijuana interacts with chemicals in the brain, normal chemicals in the brain, especially teenagers. She said many people think it's natural, so it can't be toxic or bad for you. There are marijuana neurotransmitters, receptors in the brain, and a young preteenager whose brain is still developing, you want to avoid chemicals that interfere with that process, she explained. Same thing can be said for some of these psychoactive drugs that these kids are put on. British Medical Journal, don't trust me, even as medical legalized little guidance on when to use, especially for chronic pain, a lot of it is fake out there, by the way. So here's something. Use in the United States of America. Did you ever read the book Brave New World?
You know, I've not read that book, but I am very familiar with the subject matter.
So in it, Aleister Huxley created a drug called Soma.
Yes.
We get messaging from big government, big news against tobacco, which is warranted. Tobacco is a killer. Why is the same media lauding weed as some kind of panacea and always singing its praises? You have to read Brave New World to understand that. FDA warns companies to stop making false claims for CBD and THC products. The companies have been selling products with Delta 8, the number 8, THC, a compound that has psychoactive and intoxicating effects. Currently, no FDA-approved drugs contain Delta 8 THC. We know they are unregulated. We know the government doesn't want you to do it, so it must be good for you, right? Us rebels. Many who rely on bud tenders, not bartenders, but bud tenders, whose job is to sell you marijuana, not give you medical advice, but they don't know what they're talking about, just potheads working to get discounts. Very important for you to know that. One of the most deceptive of all drugs, makes you think you're something you are not, distorts your view of reality. Saying, there is an old saying, the star behind their car. I got this from Michael Savage. You ever hear that, star behind the car?
No, I did not.
You wear a face when you're behind your fancy car. You get into your car, you think you're, you know, something you're not. You're a race car driver from you know, Thunder Road or whatever
right,
it is. You're just
right.
Not the same guy when you're at home sitting there behind your desk. Well, marijuana is the exact same thing. It does that. So I'm actually a libertarian when it comes to these issues like this. I just want to explain things to you. So especially if you're a teenager out there or have a teenager, just trying to caution you, it explains the disconnect between America and reality. Let's listen to this next clip just to break it up a little bit.
Is there anyone out there who still isn't clear about what doing drugs does? Okay, last time. This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
That's why the term getting fried was loosely used back in the day, and it's still the same thing. You're getting fried. You're frying
your
brain.
That was in the 80s. It fries your brain.
The 70s.
And that was before it got to be as potent as it is now. And you couple that with the other pharmaceuticals that they have in their system, and it's a recipe for disaster. So my perspective, and many in the medical profession that have been silenced, canceled, shut up, told to go away by big marijuana, great article by Blaine Cooper in the Star Tribune, legal marijuana will lead us to a brave new world, April 10th, 2021. Published in 1932, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World has tantalized readers ever since with its frightening prediction of the future. In order to keep the masses in line, the totalitarian government of Brave New World gives its citizens soma, a chemical designed to provide a calming and euphoric effect. People are urged to take soma whenever they feel any negative emotions and thus are kept docile. They don't rebel against their tyrannical government because they are too doped up to care. The soma that Huxley imagined in 1932 bears a striking resemblance to a certain real-world drug today, marijuana. The increasing legalization of recreational marijuana across the U.S. is a terrible thing. By looking back at Brave New World, we can see how critical the banning of mind-altering drugs is to keeping a society free. Smoking weed is often associated with rebellion and counterculture, the article says. In reality, it could be a useful method of controlling and oppressing the masses, especially the poor. In the novel, a rigid class system shapes society. The lower classes do all the menial jobs and are issued a dose of soma at the end of each workday. Their entire existence consists of waking up, working, getting high, and doing it all over again. Does this sound familiar? The American poor are disproportionately responsible for marijuana use. Their lives are quickly turning into the working, getting high, doing it again the next day cycle. Many Americans use marijuana simply to relax at the end of a hard day. But this still reinforces a cycle that rewards subservience and apathy. But why is this a problem? Many would say that marijuana and other drugs will never be so widespread in American culture that their use could be compared to Huxley's prediction. But why couldn't they? Humans are lazy by nature. We would rather have our pizza delivered than drive to pick it up. Whenever a person is sad, why would they go out and try to make themselves happy when they are encouraged to take readily available drugs? The change will be slow, but nearly inevitable. Why would the citizens in Brave New World have any motivation to improve their lives? All of their problems are solved with their daily dose of soma. It becomes nearly impossible for them to get upset. Get the picture? Clip number three, please.
See this cute little vial here? It's crack, rock cocaine, the most addictive form. You think it's the glamour drug of the 80s? Well, that's the point of this fronted little reminder. It can kill you. And if you've got to die for something, this sure as hell ain't it.
Don't even try it. That's the old Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry.
Yeah, but there's an end to that.
Here we go. The thrill can kill.
In the next few months, the motion picture industry and theater owners will be bringing you a series of messages like the one you just saw. I don't think anybody will miss the point. The thrill can kill. The drug dealers need to know that we want them out of our schools, neighborhoods, and our lives. And the only way to do that is to take the customers away from the product. Say no to drugs and say yes to life.
Of course, your local drug pusher may tell you a little something different about these drugs. And who you believe is up to you. But then again, if you go ahead and try them, at least it won't be out of ignorance. Just stupidity. What would I do if someone offered me these drugs? I'd tell them to take a hike.
Yep.
So that was Clint Eastwood, 93 years old, I think, right now. And Nancy Reagan, rest in peace, whose Just Say No campaign in the 80s turned into Thrill Can Kill. A little bit more dramatic, I would say. So it's good that they made that change. On another article from LitHub, pretty surprising there's a magazine called LitHub, but this is from March 21st, 2019. Aldous Huxley foresaw America's pill-popping addiction with eerie accuracy. Soma is not a drug of the people, but of the state, and the authoritarian state at that. In fact, If anything, what Huxley got most wrong was not the idea that powerful psychotropic drugs could, and indeed would, soon be developed to shape the human mind, nor even his paradoxical, if not outright contradictory, positions first against and then in favor of psychiatric pills, but rather his now seemingly quaint idea that any single drug, such as soma alone, could ever suffice to satisfy human beings' complex range of psychological needs, thereby producing a one-size-fits-all model of psychiatric medicine. Our world today is not just psychotropically somatic with its widespread use of pills, it is also far more polysomatic than Huxley could have ever imagined. What is perhaps most remarkable is not simply that we have indeed developed psychotropic pills as Huxley foresaw, or that we have come to accept them as Huxley himself would, including with his own nuanced reservations about their effectiveness and desirability, but that we have produced such a bewildering array of pills with the ever-increasing production of ever-new psychotropic drugs seemingly to endlessly spiral ever more out of control. Yesterday's Thorazine and Valium have become today's lithium, Prozac, and Adderall, not to mention Celexa, Lexapro, Ritalin, Ativan, Zyprexa, Xanax, Clonopin, Seroquel, Abilify, Exafor, Trazodone, Paxil, Zolo, Depakote, whatever, and whatever pill du jour tomorrow may bring, as each new generation strives to treat not only its ever-increasing potent psychological maladies, but even its evolving generational psyches and the existential quandaries of the human condition itself, with an ever-proliferating, almost blinding arsenal of ever-new psychotropic pills, he says. Clip number four, please.
I get angry just thinking about it makes me mad. Little kids doing drugs, it turns my stomach. That stuff hurts. It stops you from living up to your potential. It holds you back. It hurts the user. It hurts his family. And it hurts his friends. I just want to shake some sense into you kids that are using drugs and thinking about using. So remember, don't, or else. Okay?
That was Mr. T. Famous
Mr. T. Loved him in Rocky. Yep. Well, hated him in Rocky, but loved him in Rocky. Huxley's characters lack ambition, curiosity, or even any meaningful understanding of the human experience. Empathy. They're addicts. Just addicts. In America, we see random acts of violence and we're never allowed to ask what drugs they are on. Marijuana provokes impulses very hard to control in many people, as any addict will tell you after they've been in recovery, especially kids. Clip number five, please.
Hey, Davey, get lost, will you?
Hey, let the kid in.
Oh, hey, I know.
What are you doing?
Hey, Davey, want to try something?
Hey, come on, man, leave him alone.
Come on, try it, Davey.
I don't like this.
Try it. Come on, take a hit.
No, thanks.
Kid's gonna be all right.
If someone offers you drugs...
What is it with you guys?
Just say no.
I love the 80s. After 50 years of telling us it was the most dangerous drug on earth, now they tell us it's the most helpful. And real quick, this item jumped out at me. For 2 years running, the Georgia Bulldogs have been a tour de force in college football. They have lost just once in their last 30 games, stumbling against Alabama in the SEC championship game on December 2021. In the college football playoffs of 2022, they eked out a one-point win, 42-41, in a thrilling semifinal championship against Ohio State before trouncing TCU 65-7 in the championship game. So head coach Kirby Smart and the rest of the Bulldogs have much to celebrate. But once again, their celebration tour will not include 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue after they declined yet another invite to visit the White House. The University of Georgia Bulldogs have once again declined an invitation to visit the White House to celebrate their national championship. President Joe Biden and his wife, Dr. Jill, extended Georgia an invitation to participate in an event billed as College Athlete Day, scheduled for June 12th. However, the Bulldogs politely declined the invitation, citing a possible scheduling conflict. Good for you, Bulldogs. Stay tuned for my thought of the day. They're good ones. New Life Chiropractic Brentwood is a max living health center serving the greater Nashville area since 2007. You know, the ones that were members of Max Living Sports Performance Council at the 2012 London and 2016 Rio Summer Olympic Games with the U.S. wrestling and judo teams and Tennessee NFL alumni. If Dr. Dion Kellogg can help those hardworking spines, she can help you. I know, she helped me. I'm a patient. We all have a spine. Take care of it at New Life. You'll be amazed. Check out drkellogg.maxliving.com and schedule a health consultation at front desk at newlifecoolsprings.com. Welcome to my quotes for the day. Hopefully you see a theme. Before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. Just the minute the FBI begins making recommendations on what should be done with its information, it becomes a Gestapo. J. Edgar Hoover. Fidelity, bravery, and integrity set the expectations for behavior. They set a standard for our work. More than just a motto, for the men and women of the FBI, fidelity, bravery, and integrity is a way of life. Robert Mueller. The promise I've tried to honor my entire career that the rule of law and the design of the founders, right, the oversight of courts and the oversight of Congress will be at the heart of what the FBI does. James Comey. The spine of the FBI is the rule of law. The spine of the FBI is commitment to doing the right thing in the right way while protecting civil liberties. Also James Comey. Same guy. Don't know what happened. The FBI's mission is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. That mission is both dual and simultaneous. It is not contradictory. Christopher A. Wray. Here's what I believe. I think the FBI is the premier law enforcement agency in the history of the world, but I think there was some bad apples over there. John Kennedy. December 15, 2022. We spoke to someone who had access to these still hidden CIA documents, a person who was familiar deeply with what they contained. We asked this person directly, quote, did the CIA have a hand in the murder of John F. Kennedy, an American president? And here's the reply we received verbatim, quote, the answer is yes, I believe they were involved. It's a whole different country from what we thought it was. It's all fake. Tucker Carlson. Clip number one, please.
But he's taking these shots, this antagonism, yep. This taunting to the intelligence community.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
What do you think the intelligence community would do if they were motivated?
I don't know, but from what I am told, they are very upset with how he has treated them and talked about them.
3 years ago, Senator Chuck Schumer said the intelligence community was very angry at the president and has six ways from Sunday to get back at him. We've seen about five run against Trump. What the hell could number six be? That's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Steve Friend, for keeping the government honest and renewing our faith that good guys exist. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. For our iTunes and Spotify listeners, sorry, Rumble, stay tuned for another guest appearance by me. This was yesterday on Fault Lines in D.C. Host Jamarl Thomas and Austin Pelley talked to me about Title 42. I'm an expert on 1940s enacted CDC regulations dealing with pandemics, I guess. I hope you like it. Peace in our time.
Welcome back to Fault Lines on Radio Sputnik. My name is Jamarl Thomas. I'm joined with Malik Abdul, coming to you live out of our station in Washington, D.C. And let's get to our guest, Steve Abramowitz. I'm going to get him to correct me if I got that wrong. And we're going to be having a conversation of Title 42. He is host of Mill Creek View Podcast. Steve, welcome to the show. Did I get your name correct?
You did, actually. Abramowitz.
Abramowitz. Excellent.
What is going on?
Not too much. Just doing the news. And, of course...
not too much at all.
All right. To be honest, there's all sorts of news afoot today, so we have a packed show. But I want to get to Title 42, because we were believing when Title 42 basically was removed and Title 8 was put into play, that it was going to be a massive flood. Now, to be fair, there were hundreds of thousands of people basically waiting at the border for weeks in advance of Title 42 ending. So it's fair to get that assessment. But this morning, though, they're saying that they're not seeing these kind of massive surges and spikes that they were expecting at the border. Give me an understanding of what is taking place.
So according to Border Patrol Union President Brandon Judd, there are 10,000 apprehensions per day, regardless of Title 42, which is a scam because it was all about disease prevention back in 1944.
Right.
That poor Donald Trump had to dust off and bring out of obscurity. Some lawyer found it for him because everybody was attacking him for wanting to build a wall and stop this immigration thing. But what they never talk about, the numbers you just cited, are the 3,000 gotaways per day, which is about a million a year, that are bringing in the fentanyl, the child trafficking, et cetera, et cetera. So we got a problem on our hands, and it's not just yesterday when Title 42 expired at midnight.
Well, they're saying over the past 2 days, the U.S. Border Patrollers experienced a 50% drop in the number of encounters versus what they were experiencing earlier in the week before Title 42 ended.
So they specifically on Sunday, 6,300, and on Friday on Friday there was 6,300, and then on Saturday there was 4,200, which is not, as they said, the 11,000
right.
per day. So the question is, you know, the why, but
yeah.
they're also saying that they expect those numbers to go up. So they
yeah.
don't know. At least no one seems to know why
the number
on
dipped.
Those particular, like,
the
over the weekend.
Expectation was we're going to get slammed. I mean, looking at
right.
some of the lines and everything else, he was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, but guys, you have to keep in mind, Title 42 made it really hard to get accurate numbers of migrants who are attempting to cross into the U.S. That's
mm-hmm.
because many migrants have been trying to cross multiple times in the same month. They get counted more than once.
Mm.
That's according to Mayorkas.
No.
So whatever numbers they're giving us, kind of remind me of some of the other numbers that the government's been telling us for the last decade
Herbie
that we
Dodger.
Can't really rely on to for 6 months when they actually reevaluate them and then they restate them. So I don't know. I wouldn't be too keen on 4 days worth of numbers being down 50%.
Oh,
why
agreed.
Would that even be? We've seen the drones showing the footage of everybody marching across. The border's
yeah.
open. Come on in. And we know that ICE and Border Patrol can't do a darn thing about it because the government won't let them.
But see, that's to your point. All of the, where did they go?
Right.
Like all of the pictures
yeah.
and everything that we've seen. Or and the question is, and I'm wondering, is it a...
Where do they go? They went into everybody's neighborhoods. They end up on buses and airplanes and they fly them all over the place and never tell them. And we've seen pictures in the middle of the night where they just hit the ground and they end up in a tent on the street. It's terrible. It's a human catastrophe.
I'm curious. Tell us about Title 8 and the difference between Title 8 and Title 42. Meaning, why did Biden and Trump rely on Title 42 as opposed to using Title 8?
44. Okay. So Title 42 came around in 1944. You have to know what Title 41 and 43 were to actually understand this, but it was basically so that the CDC could take emergency action against a pandemic. Well,
right.
what did we just go through in the last 2 years? Hopefully everybody still remembers. A pandemic that gave Trump the opportunity to say, let's pause this. So Biden didn't have to do anything. He just sat on his hands and the whole thing expired because it was over. It just happened to carry over into the next administration. It's actually Congress that has plenary powers that the Supreme Court has over and over again acknowledged, written in the darn thing to make this happen. So, you know, the fact that we have a Republican majority in Congress right now has a lot to say for the fact that they can't do anything. So Title 8, Title 42, jaywalking, doesn't matter. It's all about our ICE and America actually enforcing the laws on the books for almost 100 years. No.
Well, but that doesn't explain what Title 8 is, because that's basically what's taking place right now at the border.
Well, how do you justify 8 versus 42? Because 8 would be the same exact thing I'm talking about. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution for full going powers and all of the powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof. That's longstanding Supreme Court precedent recognizing Congress as having power over immigration, giving it almost complete authority to decide whether foreign nationals, aliens, under government statute and case law, may enter or remain in the United States. And that's the key. They are allowed to enter, and they are allowed to remain because there's no ICE or Border Patrol to enforce it. Their morale has been thrown in the garbage. They become the enemy.
So the difference,
just clear, there are no ICE and there's no border control, and they're not enforcing control of the border?
Well, there's not no. They live there, but their job has become changing diapers and feeding formula to these unaccompanied minors and babies. And we've seen the pictures. Ted Cruz went viral with his video of showing the kids in cages again and all this terrible stuff. It's a humanitarian crisis.
I just want to nail something down, though. They are not, the border agents are only changing diapers. They are not handling cases of people coming across the border and in some cases stopping people, or for that matter.
Well, that's a job for judges, and the judges have been appointed who don't really care. And so these folks get a court date 10 years out. There's videos of that showing that they're supposed to return in 2027, and they don't even return when they're told to come back the very next day because the laws are not being enforced. And even if they are, it doesn't matter. No one's checking the backpacks to see if there's fentanyl or marijuana in there. No one's checking to see if the kids are related to the parent. And then they end up in the terrible sex trade. We've got slavery going on in this world right now, more so than during the Civil War, and it's terrible. It is an absolute catastrophe because the administration, whether it be Congress or the White House or the Supreme Court or the judges at the border, aren't doing what they're supposed to do. And guess who's hurt by this? We saw a video viral of an African-American lady who's a teacher saying this illegal immigration into our city of Chicago is devastating for our jobs. It is not, I don't know what to say other than it's not a good thing. It's not a good look for America to be doing this when people are leaving communism, leaving terrible situations, leaving environmental disasters to come here and work in slave labor conditions. McDonald's even is doing it with 10-year-olds, which is against the employment labor law. So we got a problem.
Steve, I think we probably could agree that that was a bit of hyperbole. I don't think that anything was like, I don't think anything now is worse than what happened during the Civil War and definitely slavery, because the numbers
of human slaves at the moment dwarfs Jesus' time and dwarfs the Civil War.
So I think what my distinction,
human capital.
Yeah. So I think what my distinction would be is that there was no free will involved in slave, because you were enslaved. You had no choice to come here. You had no choice. You were born into slavery. And so I don't think that that is the same as what we're seeing for the migrants who are choosing to come to the border. But on the larger issue, because we've had people on, you know, we've had reporting from on the ground, is that obviously there's a lot that the Border Patrol agents are doing at the border. So there's a combination of doing some of those things that you did mention, you know, like the diaper change. You know, we have seen reports of stuff like that. But the Border Patrol agents, if you listen to them, if you listen to even the unions, they have to do a lot, much more than what they should be, because the government is just simply not giving them the resources that they need. But they are definitely doing a lot at the border. Just a bit of...
But you realize that's only day one, right? I mean, once they get their feet on the ground and they get into those camps, or whatever you want to call them, cages, as we saw the pictures all the way back to the Obama era, so I'm not blaming anybody in particular. It's just the way that they've been trying to process these folks. Once they get into the interior of the country, making every state a border state, they got to go to work. They got to start paying back the cartel or the coyote that brought them across the country in the first place, whether it was voluntary or indentured servitude. That's a different story, but they have to pay that money back, and they may not like the job they're being forced to do, whether it be work in the back of a McDonald's or sell fentanyl on the corner of the street or, God forbid, child sex trafficking where they have to sell their little bodies.
All right, now that part I agree with.
What I would consider slavery, like in the South in the Civil War, this is a different kind of slavery. This is human trafficking.
Well, that part I agree with. The whistleblower said that to Congress, that basically our laws was creating these situations where people, they didn't necessarily know who the kids were going to. And so you had these kind of child work conditions where the kids were working at like farming or these kind of disastrous jobs. Fair enough. Agreed. But that wasn't your argument. Your argument was that Biden wasn't allowing these guys to do their jobs. And by the way, if you put them in a cage, that is them doing something, meaning you can't have it both ways. You can't say they're people in cages by the same token. DHS or these other agencies aren't doing their job. I guess my thing is a hyperbole.
You can, sir, because they end up in the cage for maybe 3 or 4 days. Then they end up in Des Moines, Iowa, working in the back of a McDonald's where they just got burned by grease vat because he shouldn't have been anywhere near it. He didn't understand how the job works.
So, okay, so there is no situation. Meaning there's nobody that DHS is expediting, getting rid of, and not allowing to come into the country. Because that's the problem I have with these conversations. We had another person on who was basically saying that that Border Patrol wasn't able to use drones, which is farcical. We had other conversations. Look, I agree with you with the bringing the fentanyl into the country.
Drone just gives you digital camera images of what's happening. It doesn't solve anything.
I know, but her argument was basically that they weren't using them. I'm saying the hyperbolic language in regards to the right on the border is excessive. That's all.
And even under the Trump administration in
Wait, if you want to get down into the numbers, I'm happy to do it. I didn't know how much time we actually had, but Border Patrol.
No, you misunderstand my point.
Known or suspected terrorists last year, 98 known or suspected terrorists. In 2021, the number was 15.
I don't doubt.
Something's changed.
Look, I don't doubt that there are people coming across the border with fentanyl. I believe the overwhelming majority, however, are looking for work. And you can make an argument that they may damage certain communities. Again, fair enough. That's more of a nuanced conversation.
I don't disagree with you at all. No. We're talking millions of people, and I think the overwhelming percentage absolutely would love the American dream, love to come here,
yes,
get a great job, do all this wonderful stuff. But in the meantime, 856 deaths at the border last year, making it the deadliest year on record. Well, okay, we had more than 856 people come across the border, so it's a small percentage, but isn't one death too many? They could come legally and stay in a hotel, and it would be, you know, very nice and very comfortable. But this is somebody willing to risk their life and losing their life because the border is not using the normal chains and channels of legal immigration that we've had for 200 years.
Okay, so we just have about a minute and a half left, Steve. And typically when we have people on, we ask them the set question. So if you were able to advise, whether that's a Democrat or even a Republican presidential candidate, on one or two things, we can even go with one that is a non-enforcement related, that would actually help solve the border crisis, what would you say? And the reason that I'm bringing non-enforcement, because we always get the answers about border walls and other security at the border. What other thing outside of security would you suggest to a presidential candidate?
Very simple. End catch and release and reinstate remain in Mexico. It would be tax-free to the taxpayer. It would solve the problem instantly. And that's what we see right now not being done. Catch and release is in effect. They end up in the middle of the country, and they don't get to remain in Mexico. They get to walk across the border where you've seen the open doors with the Border Patrol walking them right in, taking them right to processing, handing them a slip of paper with a form letter on saying, see you in 2027, and we'll deal with this later. End that, end catch and release, reinstate, remain in Mexico, problem solved. You and I aren't talking about it on the news today.
And just a point of clarity, so Title 42 and Title 48, so Title 42 is not considered traditional immigration policy. Title 48, the difference there is that Title 48 makes it easier to file an asylum claim.
You mean Title 8?
I mean, Title 8 makes it easier to file asylum claims than Title 42.
Mm-hmm. And so, the wait is longer and all this other stuff, which creates more difficulty and longer lines. Okay, fair enough. I'm Steve. Thank you for this, man. I appreciate you joining us. Steve Abramowitz, he's host of Mill Creek View Podcast. You guys are listening to Fault Lines. Thomas, Abdul, back in a moment. Just like rolling thunder.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.